But Derek, how would you be able to tell?
Right, let's go. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining Derek's live chat show. It's the 73rd one since the first lockdown and the first one in the second lockdown here in the United Kingdom. Got a lot of friends and colleagues on today from the Professional Speaking Association, from the Golden Gate Breakfast Club, and some other friends from Slovenia and other places in the world. Thank you so much for joining us. Great pleasure to have Graham Davis with us today. He's the presentation coach, and I'm just going to mute everybody because I forgot to do that in my move to get everybody going. Graham, you'll have to unmute yourself because you're muted at the moment. And you're still muted, I think. And Graham joined us in July. Graham gave us a fantastic presentation in July. And he said that if Trump got in, he would eat his words. And I closed the sale very quickly and persuaded him to talk to us the week after the American election. Graham, it's a great pleasure to have you here from Gran Canaria, which is in the Canary Islands, just off the African coast. I don't know what you're doing there. I think you need to explain that and explain to us what actually happened over in the USA. And we've got some of our US friends here checking up on whatever you say, mate.
Well, I can't possibly comment on any allegations or rumours on any websites that I'm working for a Ukrainian billionaire here in a mansion in Gran Canaria. So I'd like to swiftly move on from those rumours. Just to say that one thing that you didn't say in your introduction was that, having carefully looked at the manuscript transcript of the session in July, I did in fact say that there were only two results possible, and that was a narrow win for Biden or a big win for Biden. Now, in fact, it's been a medium-sized win for Biden. So, in fact, I was wrong.
Well, that makes a change, doesn't it, Graham, for you to be wrong, actually, on something. I've known you for 15 years, and you've always stood on stage and said you were right, despite people throwing things at you. And, of course, you're an after-dinner speaker as well. I've never laughed at any of your jokes, but we won't worry about that. Now,
believe me, Derek, that feeling has been mutual.
Tell me, Graham, tell me what your thinking was and what happened over the last 2 weeks, because I've been bemused by the whole thing.
Well, we had a presidential election where there were two candidates. And of course, we've all met people at parties where they're continually saying, me, 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 me. It's all about me, all about me. But hey, enough of me talking about me. What do you think of me before I carry on talking about myself? And I think we had one of those as one of the candidates over the last, not just 2 weeks, but he's been a candidate for re-election over the last 3¾ years. Because really, the two candidates, each of them had a secret slogan. One candidate's secret slogan was, my name is Donald Trump. And the other candidate's secret slogan was, my name is not Donald Trump. And that was his key presentational weapon in getting just enough votes in just enough of the swing states to make a difference. And I'll give a quick overview of how that happened before possibly taking questions and going into more detail later. But I think I do need to make clear three prejudices that I have to admit right at the outset. Number one, I accept I am an outsider from the United States. I do love the United States, everything that it stands for. I love all of its systems. I love all of its people who've been incredibly welcoming to me. But I accept that the fact that I'm an outsider and watching the election from the outside may in fact distort the picture for me, and I accept that. Number two, I should declare that apart from being rather liberal on things like gender discrimination or what I perceive to be racial discrimination, I am very much a right-wing conservative. I probably would be a Reaganite Republican if I was an American citizen. Thirdly, I also have to admit to a certain amount of personal bias, I would call it, bias or judgment against the media. from some personal experience I've had over the years, but also experiences that individual political clients have had. Despite those three prejudices that I've admitted, I am going to try and be as objective as I possibly can be in my comments, but I think it only fair that you know about those three prejudices of mine in assessing whether you agree with my comments.
And Graham, just for everybody's benefit, are a political presentation coach, which means you're not a speech coach. So you advise people on how to present their material rather than writing the material. And it's
that's not strictly correct. What I am, I'm a political presentation coach. I coach politicians on what to say and how to say it when they're under pressure. So other people draft speeches for them using my techniques and with me coaching them through the process. But when it comes to the actual final draft of the speech, I polish it so that it's ready for battle conditions. But I'd certainly then, of course, also coach them on various types of delivery and honing their delivery. But when it comes to TV debates and TV interviews, I coach them on every aspect of what they say and do. The only thing that I'm not is a speech writer from the ground up.
Okay, thanks for clearing that up. That's great.
Now, I start from the premise that, in fact, despite what many political campaigners would like to believe, political campaigns rarely make a difference to the way that the vast majority of voters vote. However, when an incumbent has been ousted, something must have made a difference, especially in the current United States, where frankly, there's been an awful lot of entrenchment over the last couple of decades, so that there are a lot of states that frankly will always vote Republican for the rest of our lifetimes. There are a lot of states that will always vote Democrat for the rest of our lifetimes. So the something that has happened to make some states swing, as it were, must have been quite significant. Another premise that I start with is that the vast majority of people in the vast majority of national elections, certainly in the United States and in the United Kingdom, vote on the basis, quite rightly, on what they feel is good for their pockets. They vote for their, they vote with their wallets, essentially. But I believe on this occasion, although the vast, vast majority of hundreds of millions of people were still voting with their wallets, there were a small but significant number in about half a dozen states who, against their wallet protection instinct, actually voted with their hearts and their guts as well. And they voted with their hearts because of their emotional distaste for Donald Trump. And I'm not saying that that was a huge number of people, but I do say that it was a large enough number of people, especially perhaps in Arizona, to make the crucial difference, to make them swing towards Joe Biden. That's my overview, and I could go into an awful lot of detail to try and justify that, Derek.
Okay, Graham, thanks for that. Would you put your any questions for Graham in the chat box before we move on? And I know one or two people, and maybe Patricia, have to leave at quite an early stage. So if there's any questions or anybody wants to say anything at an early stage, we would welcome some opinions if you're able to give it from the USA. Okay, Graham, so what happened? What really happened is the question, isn't it? Inside. And you said these things happen in most democratic elections in most countries around the world as well.
Well, it's very difficult to see, for instance, let's look at the 2019 British general election. Although people moan about election polling results being accurate or not accurate, and they will do this time in relation to the American elections, the Tories at the start of the 5.5 week campaign were 9.5 points ahead. And at the end of the 6.5 week campaign, they were 9.5, maybe 10 points ahead. So the campaign hadn't made much difference. But the way I look at this American campaign is that the American campaign for this election in 2020 actually started on the 21st of January, 2017, because Donald Trump's inauguration speech was in fact his first attempt to do a re-election speech. The narrative started straight away that he was going to continually fire up his base as if it was a general election campaign. That the inauguration speech is usually, whether it's a Democrat winner or whether it's a Republican winner, it's usually an attempt to try and put salve over the wounds of a bitter general election campaign and bring a country together and attempt to say that you're going to try and be a president for all Americans, and in fact, for the whole world. But Donald Trump's inauguration speech was a rather bitter, angry, and divisive one, in which he talked about American carnage as he clenched his fists, and indeed, at one stage, did a double fist pump into the camera, almost as if he was starting a campaign rather than celebrating the end of one. And again, we saw a massive start of the continued combativeness the next day, the very next day, over the issue of the crowd size at the inauguration. Sean Spicer, the new White House press spokesman, marched onto the stage and said that the newspapers and the TV companies were all lying about the small size of the Trump inauguration crowd. And they said that despite the photographs, it was quite clear that Trump had got a far bigger crowd than Obama had at any of his inaugurations. Frankly, this was the very first big, fat, shouted lie of the 2020 presidential campaign. And this was the first time we heard the phrase alternative facts. This is the first example of what I will call his FAR approach. And FAR is an acronym which I've created specially for this presentation today. F-A-R. Everything that Donald Trump could say for the next 3.5 years could potentially either, number one, fire up his own support, or number two, could attract new people to be Trump supporters, or number three, it could revolt people and drive them away. So everything that I say, all these things that he presented over the next 3.5 years, and especially in the last few weeks of the campaign, you might all find it useful to consider that FAR formula. Does this thing that I've said that he said fire up his supporting base? Does it attract floating voters, or does it revolt people and drive them away? Because let's face it, any politician, Trump or anyone else, has only got one weapon: words. The words that he chooses to say and the way that he chooses to say them, or in his case, tweet them. And I believe that those words, if you apply the FAR formula that I've just given you over the last 3.75 years, they certainly did fire up an enormous number of his supporters. And indeed, actually, he got a record number of votes for any presidential election, apart from Joe Biden, who got an even bigger record number of votes. But despite getting a record number of votes, the way you should look at it is that Donald Trump managed to revolt a record number of people to vote against him. Does that make sense to you so far, Derek?
Yeah, I think it does, Graham. It makes a lot of sense. You mentioned in July that you thought he was losing the female vote. Is that the case, before I bring in any of our American friends?
Well, I've looked at the statistics on this. I felt that was the case. I think it's always dangerous to blanket generalize about one sex. I think that's a, dare I say, that's a sexist thing in itself. But the stats that I've seen don't suggest that he I thought he would massively alienate the base, the female vote. To be fair, unless Tim or anyone else wants to correct me on this, although my gut instinct says that, I don't think the stats in the exit polls suggest that. What I do think also from an early stage was a huge mistake, as well as not reaching out to people beyond his base. He just fired up his base. He assumed that his base was going to be enough to carry him through and get re-election. He also did something very peculiar, which started right with that rant by Sean Spicer about the press supposedly lying about the size of the inauguration crowd. That was the start of a tendency over the next 3 3/4 years of the succeeding spokespeople that he had, also other various people within the Trump organization, but especially him in his speeches and his tweets, of attacking the mainstream media in general, coining this phrase fake news, attacking individual organizations in general, sometimes even his pets at Fox News, but even more strikingly, attacking individual journalists and labeling them all as liars. Now, as I say, I do have a certain prejudice against the media in my own country. And I think that sometimes a tendency to deal with the truth isn't as good as it should be. However, there is one thing that we do have to accept. Journalists are human beings. I know that's a radical thing to suggest, but they do get upset. If you start your presidency not only attacking individual organizations, but attacking in really quite a vicious, nasty, personal way individual journalists, you're bound to make them as enemies for the next 3.5 years. Mm. They're bound not to give you necessarily the fairer shake, because the most objective, the most hard-hearted journalist is still a human being with feelings. And I think it was a big presentational mistake to continually fire them up as essentially his enemies.
Graham, I'll give you a break now. I'm going to bring Tim in from Texas to see what his views were from an interesting state. Are you there, Tim?
Yes, I am. Derek and everyone, I am proud to say that I am the Democratic Party and the Republican Party's biggest nightmare. I am an independent voter who will split his ticket and has split his ticket for the last several elections. And what splitting your ticket means is that I will vote for the people that I want, regardless of Democrat or Republican. I don't go straight Democrat, I don't go straight Republican. And therefore we are not predictable. It was not at all surprising that Donald Trump lost this election, but it is surprising that he got so many votes. And there are undercurrents in this election that I think everybody needs to be aware of, especially if you're a Democrat. African-American women voting for Trump doubled in number. African-American men who have college degrees or are in college increased by a significant percentage. But the biggest change is the Hispanic vote. The Hispanic vote has, for people who are established in this country legally, is growing in support of conservative causes, if you will. They turned out for Trump. They turned Florida massively in Trump's favor, and that was the Cuban population. Why did they do that? Why is the Hispanic vote changing? Because they all come from socialist countries, or they escaped socialist regimes, if you will. As a matter of fact, it was pointed out in Miami by somebody that's running that the Democrat who is running literally said things out of the Marxist socialist playbook used in the Cuban Revolution. So there's a lot of interesting things. What turned a lot of, I believe, what I call reasonable people away from Trump isn't just the bullying and the tweeting. It's the fact that 500 generals, 22 retired four-star generals, the highest rank, voted for Biden and verbally supported Biden. Now, these are people who worked with Trump or were close to Trump, like Jim Mattis and Bill McRaven, who did the Osama raid, the Geronimo raid, just a lot of them. And if these people that close are worried about and cannot support them, I think there's a big lesson there. Lots of subtext in this election. The Democrats came out anti-Trump and not pro very much anything other than socialism. It's going to be a long time for America goes for that.
Thanks, Tim. I'll come back to you in a minute. Graham, back to you. We've got a question in the chat box, which something we discussed last week. To what extent were the polls an accurate predictor of the election?
In Florida, Texas, and Iowa, they were horribly wrong. Not only about who would win those states, but the amount. Just dramatically wrong. Even in the Rust Belt states, they were predicting big wins for Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. But they for Biden, whereas in fact they were only sort of moderate win, narrowish wins for Biden. They also were horribly wrong in North Carolina, suggesting that Biden had a shout. Interestingly, I think that the crucial state where they were closest to being accurate was in Arizona. And I'm open to correction on the numbers on this. And Arizona was a particular place where there'd been an increase in the Hispanic population, as I understand it. But also, remember, this is the home of John McCain. I suspect that there were a significant number of long-term Republicans who found that the words that Donald Trump said about John McCain, a respected war hero over a long period of time, that Trump said about him while he was alive, and Trump even said about him when he was dead, that they found him utterly revolting. I suspect that a good big stream of mainstream Republicans deliberately voted against Trump in Arizona. And just finally, in relation to the amount that the polls were wrong, they certainly were completely wrong about the total number of votes. It was an incredibly high turnout. Trump got a higher turnout number of votes than any other presidential candidate in history. But Biden got an even bigger turnout than that. But the amount of the popular vote difference was certainly not accurately portrayed by the polls. So I think the pollsters have still got an awful lot of work to do in order to regain their credibility.
Graham, one of the things we talked about in the rehearsal was, why do people lie to polls? And as we got a psychologist on the call, Graham Jones, get my Graham's muddle up, so many Grahams. I wondered if Graham had a view on why people lie to polls.
Well, people lie for all kinds of reasons, but they'd be lying to pollsters because they don't want to reveal to pollsters what they are really going to do. People are very shy. We've had the concept of shy Trump voters, but they'll be shy Democrat voters as well. So people don't like revealing what they're going to do for something that they perceive to be a secret. They also want to put people off. So, for example, when we get people knocking on the door here for general elections, I tell every candidate I'm voting for them. And so their statistics are completely wrong. And I lie to them because it avoids any conversation or wasting my time. And so the polls are useless in the way they're done. Yeah, there's billions of pounds spent on them and they're a complete waste of time because people will lie for a variety of reasons, unless they do proper testing where you can. So as a psychologist, I would have to do testing and questioning that would work out whether or not the person is lying. So you do what's called balancing questions, which asks the same question in a reverse way later on in the survey, so that you can then work out if they are lying or not. And if that reveals they're lying, you can take them out of the sample. But they don't do that in the polls because people won't do extensive questionnaires. They haven't got time. So in research, I can do it. But for pollsters, they haven't got the time to do that. So they're a complete waste of time.
Clearly,
and for the parties, a complete waste of money.
Can I mention something at that point, Derek, just to come back on Graham? That's a very interesting point of view, and I do understand what Graham says, that in order to try and work out whether someone really has told the truth in a conversation, you have to ask a reverse question again, to give them the chance to trip themselves up. But as I understand it, the polls that they carry out, let's say they make 10,000 calls to a particular town, only 100 people will answer the phone, and only 10 people will carry on with the conversation. So I understand that's only a tiny number of people who want to participate, but those 10 people out of 10,000 have chosen to participate and to answer the questions. They could easily just not answer the phone or just put the phone down as soon as it's a pollster, as 90% of people do. I can't quite understand why those 10, that 0.01% of people who pick up the phone and do want to carry on with the conversation, I can't understand why they would bother to do that and lie.
Because that's about their motivation, why they want to do that. So people are motivated to do things for all kinds of reasons. So we all receive spam from people and viruses on computers and so on that are merely there simply because the person is motivated by the fact they can do it. So you will have people motivated to answer pollsters and take part in the survey simply because they can put the pollster off the right direction. So they go away thinking, I've done it, I've achieved something. It's about their sense of personal achievement. It's a bit like Derek would say in terms of doing a deal. There are some people who want to do a deal just so they can say, I've done a deal, not because they've got a win-win, but they think they've achieved something. So it's about their sense of personal achievement. They feel that they've achieved something over the pollster. That's what motivates them.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting there. Just on the side, most takeovers fail, and they fail because everybody gets wound up into the deal, wanting to close the deal. All the investment bankers, etc., and advisors take their great big fees, and no one stands back and says, is this a good deal for the merger of the two companies? And I think it's something like 70% of mergers fail because everyone gets wrapped up in the deal. Graham, you look like Graham Davis. You look like the sun's coming round on you, and that coffee pot's going to fall on your head in a minute. But apart from that,
I've got it there deliberately just to tease you all.
Actually, I saw that earlier, Derek. And I thought that if Graham is in the pay of a Ukrainian billionaire, he could have afforded to get him a better coffee pot.
Well, the good news is that he spent all his money on my fees and not on condoms.
That explains it.
I thought you could have got a better apartment, Graham, with a coffee percolator, as there's no one in Gran Canaria apart from you. But
I seem to have the whole of Gran Canaria to myself. In fact, I don't just have this apartment to myself. I have the whole a triple apartment complex to myself. And they see, I like to work out a little bit, and I've got a particular flag on my mask. And I think I'm being patriotic with my flag. Whereas a shortish Spanish chap came up to me and sort of did what would have been like a fist punch against my shoulder, but he did a socially distanced one, which was quite weird. He said, welcome, you're from Russia, aren't you? And I said, yeah, that's right, yeah. Because why would one argue it and ruin his day?
Graham, we've got another question in the chat box from Amy. You've been mentioning Trump against Biden. How much was it Trump and Pence versus Biden and Harris, and how much do you think Kamala Harris as a running mate swung it?
I saw PJ O'Rourke do a speech 18 months ago and say that surely nobody could lose to Trump in 18 months' time. However, the Democrat Party are going to do their very best to find that nobody. I think that, unfortunately for the Democratic Party in the medium to long term, his main tactic was indeed to be relatively subterranean, to be not very distinguishable from the background, competent, because that was indeed the way to defeat Donald Trump, who would be talking about himself all the time, moaning, complaining, whining, attacking, and not having a vision. And interestingly, the way that Donald Trump conveyed himself in the first debate, interrupting Biden 73 times, sometimes quite rudely, quite aggressively, quite clearly not wanting to abide by the rules. That played into Joe Biden's hands in two ways. Number one, when he came back and said something like, "Can you just shut up, man?" Although that wasn't the most eloquent Oscar Wilde piece of repartee, it did show that he was able to stand up to bullying. And the other thing was about it was that actually Biden does have a tendency to sort of ramble off into the middle distance and pause and stare. And then he starts the sentence again. It's sometimes as if he doesn't know what sentence he's on, or frankly, sometimes what galaxy he's in. But Trump continually interrupting him didn't give him the chance to ramble off in a frightening way like that. So actually, he was quite lucky to be up against Trump, but he didn't necessarily, I would suggest, have a huge positive factor in winning. It was much more Trump losing it, you know, and forcing people away from him. Kamala Harris, I think, did have a subliminal effect. She, in the vice presidential debate, came across as a tough prosecutor. She's very robust. She has a certain level of controlled aggression, which she does have to control, by the way, because she went over the top in terms of her negative remarks against Joe Biden during the Democratic primaries. And I think that actually harmed her quite significantly in the final primary results. I think it was a good balanced ticket. And I think that it although the Democrat side of things wasn't about, quote, firing up their base, I think people did feel very comfortable that Kamala Harris not only is an impressive lady, she looks like the 21st century should look like.
Interesting. So what happens now, Graham? We'll bring some of our American friends in here. Will Trump take this to the courts? Has he got any chance of winning? And he's installed a lawyer, hasn't he, in charge of the legal system. I don't quite understand that, gentlemen and ladies from America, but it seems he's got someone in there that's got a job for life, which sounds a bit appropriate.
Well, in my opinion, remember just about every lawsuit that has been filed so far in relation to the elections has been dismissed at the first stage. Admittedly, the sort of complex allegations that are being made, they take time to actually be made and to be created into a pile of credible evidence. But my opinion is that it won't get anywhere. And even if it does get somewhere in one particular state, it will affect a few dozen or a few hundred votes. So I think that the more he carries on with this, the more silly and pathetic he looks. Mm.
Okay. And he's going to leave America and go to play golf in Scotland, I heard one of the rumours.
Until he starts running for the primaries for 2024.
Do you really think he can do that?
I just thought I'd throw that one in there.
Oh, no. I predict that he will announce his candidacy for 2024 on Joe Biden's inauguration day. That's going to be very low rent, but it's not beyond him. Yeah, he's going to start running again.
Low rent is his speciality, Tim, I would suggest.
Has been proven time and time again. It's a pretty sad situation because all presidents previously have gone quietly into that good night. He's not going to go away until Twitter drops him. And I think that could happen very, very quickly. And don't forget, he has a lot of legal issues in front of him. He should quit suing people and start saving his money for his own lawsuits. Because he's going to be in the court a lot.
And of course, it's not just civil lawsuits. He does have some potential criminal liabilities as well.
I agree.
Tim, we can feel the emotion in your voice, which is because we know you very well. Texas was a Republican state, wasn't it? It always has been.
It has been for the last 40 years. And it's still Republican, but it's changing. We're getting a lot of people from California, a lot of people migrating from other blue states that don't like the taxes, that find things onerous. And So we are starting to turn. We also have a huge Hispanic population that is entering. So, and those typically tend to vote Democratic. But they were very, very wrong here in terms of Trump being, Biden and Trump being tied. They weren't. Trump won by 10 points, which is a lot. And they didn't flip a single seat, meaning the Democrats thought they're going to win a lot of Republican congressional seats, and they didn't win a single one.
That's why. How many people in Texas? What's the population of Texas?
18 million.
18 million. So that's almost a quarter of Great Britain. Isn't that interesting? It puts it in perspective for some of us.
I think I'm right on that. I'm going to verify before I tell a lie.
Okay, we'll believe you. Don't worry. We're very very general here, and we won't tweet it. One for Graham Davis from Ifit. What damage can Trump do before he leaves? Does he still have power to influence the law?
Well, theoretically, as I understand it, a US president can do a great deal just by issuing what's known as executive orders, which essentially are him signing a piece of paper and saying, this must happen. Now, I think in the set of circumstances that we have now, and I hope I'm not proved wrong on this, he has very little credibility in order to make those executive orders that would change things dramatically. I mean, theoretically, he still holds the nuclear football. But I hope and trust that there are enough senior people around him, and I'm not talking about Jared and Ivanka, I'm talking about other people within the White House machine, enough of them are there to stop him doing anything ridiculous and stupid. And let's face it, Joe Biden has made it very clear that he's going to do his very damnedest to make sure he undoes a lot of the things that Trump has done over the last 3¾ years.
Wow. And Amy asked, do you see a future where the states will be united? I don't know whether she means united or not united.
Well, of course, one of the crucial phrases in Joe Biden's victory speech, a phrase which not original, he took from someone else, not the first time in Joe Biden's public speaking career. He said, there's no such thing as blue states, no such thing as red states. We only have the United States. And that's a bit of a cliche. It's a bit bland. It's a bit trite. But I think that those bland, trite cliches are exactly what the American populace have needed to hear at the moment, instead of the constant, aggressive, rambling, self-obsessed drivel that we've heard from Trump, who is continuously on the attack, and sometimes, frankly, didn't even make much sense in what he was saying. A few bland cliches about making this, instead of making America great again, making the states united again, are exactly what I believe the country needs.
Graham, we're nearly coming to the end of the time. I hope you'll stay on after the recording finishes. Can I just switch back to British politics for a minute? Because since you've been on, I don't know which point Jeremy Corbyn stood down, and I don't know at which point how Boris is going to handle his relationship with Biden. I thought maybe you'd like to give us a quick 2 minutes thinking on that.
I think Joe Biden is actually Boris Johnson's secret fantasy, because really dealing with Trump for another 4 years would have been just awful for because he keeps on getting compared with Donald Trump. He keeps on being described by some of the more scurrilous journalists as Donald Trump's biggest bait. I think that although Joe Biden certainly has in an Irish sense, a Republican aspect to him, I think Biden is a decent, affable human being who can be negotiated with in a proper, decent human way. Whereas in fact, Donald Trump doesn't do that. What he means by getting a great deal is forcing people into a nasty deal that takes advantage of them and that he wins everything. I think Biden and Johnson will get on very well indeed.
And do you think Sir Keir Starmer will get a lot of those swing seats back in the north of England?
Well, Starmer's undoubtedly the best leader of the opposition that the Labour Party have had for many years. But remember, he is going to have a lot of practice being leader of the opposition, because we won't have a general election until late 2014 at the earliest.
2024.
Yes, thank you for that. This is why I'm not Chancellor of the Exchequer. Late 2024 at the earliest, which is a long time. And the only way in which the Tories will call an earlier general election is if for some reason they've done something brilliant and they think they can increase their majority. Keir Starmer is no question about it, a great advocate, a great lawyer, a great speaker, a great persuader. But the people behind him in the Labour Party, especially in the front row, are really, well, they're not of the top caliber. It's great to have a brilliant leader, but I don't think that's going to be enough for them to storm through and get a majority next time.
Okay, Graham, it's great. Well, Graham, thanks for joining us all the way from the Canary Islands. And I'm envious of the sunshine you're in, the sun moving round in your apartment, etc. Can I ask you, will you join us next year for some more political commentary? I'm going to keep a note of everything that happens and exactly what you said, so I can hold it against you if that's okay. And will you stay on to answer a few questions now?
You won't be able to keep me away from next year, and I'll stay as long as you like this evening.
Graham Davis, thanks very much for joining me. And you can see a recording of this on YouTube, and you can listen to this on www.thenegotiatorspodcast. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening.